Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Last time on the show, Deborah Fay talked about how a Catholic education matched her personal values and formed a foundation for life. Later, working with teenage boys as a counsellor offered an insight into the societal challenges they face in Australia. She raised the point that the behavioural issues we're seeing could be a result of their needs not being met. A State of the Nation report in the UK, Lost Boys, takes a deep dive into six aspects of life for boys and young men: education, employment, family, health, crime, and technology and pornography. Elements of society that everyone will be influenced by, positively or negatively. Many of which are strongly correlated across Australia and the US. Researcher for the Centre of Social Justice, Luke Taylor, is 24 and feels fortunate that he's had a great education, is employed, and has a stable family that set him up for a positive life. As you'll hear today, that's not the case for a high percentage of boys and men. Luke's personal insights into the technology and pornography impacts reveal that the online world affects everyone, regardless of their social status or gender. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me, Luke. Why was this report commissioned in the first place?
So this report actually originally came from an education visit that we'd done. So at the CSJ, we have an alliance of about 700 or 800 grassroots charities that work across the UK. And anytime we do a project, we try and feed directly out of what they're doing. So if we're going to look at something like debt or addiction or family breakdown or education failure, it'll be through the lens of some charities that we work with that work in that space. And one of our education team, well, two of them went up to a school in Halifax, so up in the northeast of England, and they were speaking to their teacher just about kind of some of the challenges in the school. And he pulled them aside halfway through and pulled out a spreadsheet that he'd done and said, "I think you guys really need to have a look at this. I've done it myself, and I've also spoken to a couple of other head teachers in the area, and we've all noticed something's going wrong with the boys. They keep failing, they're not doing well, they're falling far behind the girls, and we don't quite know why, and it seems to be happening in more than just our own school." So that got our kind of researchers thinking. They ended up writing a brief, and then we kind of went through all the usual channels to see, is this something we can pursue? We ended up being able to, which is great. And then we, from there, basically just went out and did a bunch of visits, spoken to people who work with young people, so the youth workers, teachers, sports coaches, faith groups, lots of different people. All across the country, actually, and just kind of asked a similar question. You know, what's going wrong for young men and boys? What are you seeing on the ground? And then that pairs up with kind of, I guess, my day-to-day job, which is a mixture of visits, but also looking at kind of national data sets and seeing where things are and the overall picture, so the general trends, and painting actually a fairly bleak picture. So for example, what we'll see is, I remember I went to visit a charity called The Training Cave, which is just led by this awesome guy, Jack, who's basically a boxing coach and loves it. And he brings in pupils who have been referred to a pupil referral unit. So they've basically been kicked out of mainstream education and they need to do something with their time. And it's a way to kind of keep them in the loop with the education system. And they go to this place called The Training Cave, and Jack and a couple of others, they just teach them how to box, and they get them these life skills, and they can get them kind of small apprenticeships or different kind of BTEC education things. So we sat down with him and a couple of others, and he, you know, he'll talk about what the kind of common trends are with the people coming, how many boys, how many girls, what they're struggling with, this kind of thing. So I remember him saying something about, well, the different kinds of vapes that they use and the kind of the challenges they're having with AI and how kids are spending more and more time talking to the AI chatbots on Snapchat and all this kind of stuff. So then that kind of informed some of the policy side, which we had a look at. Okay, what are kids looking at online? You know, how many of them are using AI? What are they using it for? These, and we basically ended up finding that more and more people are using it. 90% of boys used it in the last year, and about 30% of them used it for things like just chatting. But then as you go down the scale, there's, you know, 10% used it for therapy and 6% because they didn't have anyone to talk to. And so we're starting to paint this picture of, okay, so we've got this whole base of technology, but within it, we've got, what are we going to look at for AI and how's actually that affecting our lost boys in the UK?
Out of all of those categories you described earlier, what did the report highlight that you found confronting or that would require urgent action?
Oh, hard to pick. I'll give you just two or three little highlights. I think probably the biggest one was we have these thing called NEETs. So these people who are not in education, employment or training. And currently in the UK, we have a big, you know, challenge with our welfare of people not in work and receiving benefits. And we've got a lot of people going there and more every year. So we're trying to work out what's feeding this. But actually young people, the rise in the number of young NEETs especially has been something we really saw recently. And since COVID, the number of male NEETs jumped up by 40%. And the same time frame actually only jumped up 7% for women. So we've now got well over 500,000 young men who are classified as NEET. And young, we're talking kind of 16 to 24, who aren't doing, frankly, we don't really know what they're doing because they're not in education, they're not employed, and they're not doing any form of formal training. You know, well over 500,000 young men in their prime who should be, you know, just about getting on the career ladder, not doing anything. So that was a real, quite a striking find. And actually on that, that's a really interesting trend reversal. So 30 years ago, the kind of number of NEETs that were men and number of NEETs that were women was very much kind of men were up here, women were below them. And over the last 30 years, they've just swapped. And it's now about 60-40 the other way, where about 60% of NEETs are men and about 40% of them are women. So something really is affecting the young men in particular there. And actually, you know what, it's been seen as a compliment to girls because they've, over the last 50 years, we've had a lot less of them. So that's been brilliant. But just in the last 5-10 years, we've really seen that shift where boys have started failing to get into work. I'd also say educationally, we've had some really interesting findings that boys are behind from nursery all the way to university and every stage of education within. So even when they go to school, it's interesting. One of our Prime Minister's milestones is that he wants 75% of kids to be school ready by the age of 5. And currently as the nation, we're at 67%. But if we split between boys and girls, girls are already at a rate of 75% and boys are ready at just 60%. So really we're thinking, okay, well, again, something's going on with boys. And they're outnumbered about 3-2 all the way at the top of university. So there's a variety of things in there. But there were some very striking findings. It was a fairly bleak report in many ways.
Well, the one thing I picked up on there is that the impacts from having lower education rates are rolled on into employment or lack of therefore. And of course, if you're unemployed or you don't have a purpose in society, it can often lead to health issues and definitely a deterioration in mental health. What are you seeing as a result of those types of factors in society?
Yeah, so I mean, educationally, I think in some ways it wasn't as striking to see that because boys have kind of always been doing slightly worse at school. The big shift is the university admissions, where it's really shifted now and it's about, you know, 60-40 girls. And that has then kind of slowly started feeding into the work stream. We also found the pay gap for those who are under 26 in full-time work is now reversed too. So girls are also now paid more. I mean, technically it's not paid more for the same work, but the average girl will earn slightly more than the average guy. But yes, in terms of health outcomes, boys, again, there was, it kind of depends which health outcomes you look at, but there was definitely some where boys are really, really struggling. I think the most obvious and striking one is in rates of taking their own lives. Basically every age group, boys are about 3.5 times more likely than girls to take their own lives. And that starts, I think, around 15, the age between 15 and 19. So, I mean, a really, really tragic one. But there are some other health outcomes that we thought were really interesting to look at too, which was by year 6, 25% of boys, so a quarter of them were classified as obese, which again has some quite serious health consequences down the line. But I think the most interesting one that I saw was back in 2017, we were looking at eating disorders and they said that a statistically insignificant number, so it was 0.0% of boys suffered with eating disorders. So it meant it's probably something like 5, 10, 100 boys, but it didn't count on the national register. And then 2023, they did it again and it was 5%. Now in that time, girls are on about 20%. They're way, way more likely to suffer from eating disorders. but something in the last 5 to 10 years has taken it from being almost no boys to 1 in 20. And again, it's a variety of things here, which is why we had to look quite holistically at work, family life, employment, all these kinds of things. But there's some really serious shifts happening under the current.
Is there any correlation between unemployment in boys and higher rates of crime?
You know, I don't actually know the number, but absolutely. I mean, if boys aren't doing things with their hands and they're likely to suffer, therefore, with mental health, there's a massive correlation between not working and having poor mental health challenges. And again, I think one of the big things that we know about boys and girls is their tendency to react differently when they're not doing well. So typically we'll see, and this is a generalization, of course, but it does, you know, when you look at national trends, it does play out. Girls, when they're suffering, will internalize, and that will kind of take the form of depression or anxiety or self-harm, whereas boys are much more likely to externalize this behavior, which is going to result in much more violent outbursts. And I mean, it's why I think it was 529 boys were in the youth estate last year, and it was about 11 girls. So when we're looking at the ages between 11 and 18, the youth estate is almost entirely male. And that picture is reflected in the kind of prison population we have, whereas 97% of it is men in the prison estate. There is a real correlation between not working and then poor mental health, and poor mental health and crime. I mean, I would also say one of the things we looked at that did relate very, very strongly to criminal activity, again, not obviously in all instances, but just as a general trend, was kind of a lack of a father figure, which we had quite a strong look at too. And it was 74% of children in youth custody said that they had an absent father. And that's not to say if you have an absent dad, you're going to prison, but it is to say if you're in prison, there's quite a high likelihood that you might not have had a dad at home. So we're looking again at those, how can we, you know, 2.5 million children in the UK don't have a father figure in their home. What can we then do in those situations to give them those positive male role models, those trusted adults in ways that they might not have in the home?
You've mentioned a couple of times the last 5 to 10 years where these figures seem to have flipped between female and male representations of statistics. Mm. What role do you think COVID has played in some of this?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to lay it all on COVID, because many of these trends, so I mentioned the kind of NEET numbers, there's not an education, employment or training, and the university things, those have been shifting up for, well, the NEET ones for at least 60 years. So they've kind of, as women have been coming up, men have basically been steady, and then they've slowly started coming down in the last 20. But COVID has definitely had, I think what it's done is it's sped up what was happening. So one of the things we found particularly interesting is we have a bit of a problem with excluding kids in this country. And again, that's going to be much more likely to be a boy. And actually post-COVID, we saw a massive drop down during COVID, and it's bounced back a lot higher than it was. And the same with kind of absentee pupils. COVID has really exacerbated that side. I think one of the biggest challenges it's had is in kind of social regulation of children. They've spent years, the only kind of socializing they did was through a screen, which is an entirely different reaction to what they used to in real life. We've got kids more and more turning up to school in nappies. They're struggling to actually relate to people. I think we're talking about this in the office. One of the hardest things about going from on-screen relationships to in-person, especially as a child, is how to end conversations well. Because if you're, you know, gaming, or if you're on a screen, at the end of it, you just click leave and you're done, and it's all you by yourself. And that's whenever you want, you can just leave. Whereas when you're in an actual conversation, you need to be able to kind of use those soft skills to slowly make your way out, gesture you want to leave, use your body language, be kind, and, you know, not hurt the other person by saying, I'm bored, I want to leave. So it's all those really, really small soft skills that actually kids, they didn't have the chance to develop for a good few years. And we're slowly seeing that come through. There was a teacher I was speaking to not that long ago, and then they breathed a massive sigh of relief when they were like, okay, great, the last COVID cohort is coming through this year. Hopefully we'll back to normal after that, because they've just presented a lot of different challenges, because they've not had the same opportunities most kids have.
That's true. But even for teachers, you know, even for children who were at school, they were then being taught online. So there was a massive shift out of socialising into isolation and being alone. And this went on and on and on. And we've seen impacts of that in Australia as well. You're talking about online and internet. The pornography was another aspect with technology that you explored. They're inextricably linked these days. I mean, a lot of the pornography content is accessible online and through apps on your phone. Where's the greatest harm being revealed?
I'd really recommend Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, because it tracks all this stuff from kind of 2010, 2014. And this is part of the reason I got quite passionate about this stuff, because I'm thinking, well, hang on, 2010, we're talking about young kids and teenagers, or 2014, or that I would have been 9 and 13. Oh, no. As in, that's my generation growing up. So I very much know this kind of part of it, especially. But yeah, no, the pornography side is massive. I think people are kind of struggling to point the finger at it too much, because I think they don't want to say, you know, correlation equals causation. But kind of some of the stuff we've seen in the last 10, 15 years are particularly shocking. I think some of the findings we've had, I'll lay out in child sexual abuse and exploitation, horrific, but over half of it is now conducted by a child to another child. And the average age of the perpetrator of that child is now 14. So you kind of think if it's under 18, it might be 17, 16 or 15. It's a 14-year-old boy is by vastly the most likely perpetrator of child sexual abuse and exploitation. And you're thinking, okay, what? And I think this is what adolescents highlighted quite well, is how much can we blame a 14-year-old boy for what their actions are? Now, obviously, there's responsibility they need to take when they make mistakes. But when we're seeing more and more and more 14-year-old boys make the same mistakes, I think we need to start looking at what kind of culture and environment they're being surrounded by. There are some other really interesting things that have popped up in the UK, at least, in the same time frame. We have the Centre for Addressing Strangulation has now started, and that was in 2013, because of such a big rise in the cases of asphyxiation, so strangling during sex. They're doing kind of research papers and tracking the numbers of these kinds of things and the attitudes towards it. And attitudes towards it among young people are, frankly, just completely out of touch with what every other generation before. It just gets more and more accepted to be or to strangle. And actually, I think that's something that's really affecting girls as well, because girls seem to kind of expect it or want it or something like that. We've also had two parliamentary inquiries into the number of female teachers who are receiving harassment and abuse from young teenage boys. Again, you know, what are we to expect from young teenage boys? Obviously, they're going to be a bit boisterous and, you know, more cheeky and mess around. They've always been like that. But actually, I think, you know, when we used to say boys will be boys, we mean that they'll like climb up a tree and, you know, make a stupid joke. But now I think it has these connotations of just misogynistic comments and this kind of stuff. And we didn't mean that before, but why do we mean it now? Well, what's happened to boys that has so changed them to act in the ways that they are? And I think a lot of this has to do with pornography. I mean, the average age of seeing it's 12 in the UK. Anecdotally, we've heard younger and younger and younger from the people who are working on the front lines with this stuff. And we have very good reason to believe that boys are going to be accessing a lot earlier than girls, because they're more likely to watch it more. Their friends will show it to them. They'll get curious and look it up online. Or like you say, they'll just stumble across it on the internet. I remember one practitioner, she works with mental health vulnerable people, and she basically said, oh, Twitter's a nightmare. It's basically just porn and beheadings, and yet all the while we're letting more and more young kids watch this stuff.
Yeah, which normalizes it. And you talk about adolescence and, you know, their exposure to this content. I mean, young brains aren't designed to understand things like that, and to normalize sexual and violent behavior is setting ourselves up for a major fall. What can we learn from this, and how do we protect successive generations from harm?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about this kind of online harms we're seeing, so I mentioned the child sex abuse and exploitation, the vast majority of that is online abuse. And actually, I think one of the things that we need to start looking at is when we say, you know, kids are watching violent things online or doing violent things through video games, a lot of the pushback is, okay, you know, violence online doesn't lead to violence in real life. And that may or may not be true. I'm not so sure. But I do think one of the things that we can probably say more easily is that violence online leads to violence online, which again is what a lot of what we're seeing in terms of this kind of really horrible speech and poor attitudes and just the way that they're conducting themselves. You know, they might shudder at the thought of being horrible to a woman in person, but actually when it's behind a screen and it's just a face, it doesn't have the same effect and feeling, because all they've done online is doesn't really matter. So I think that's something that we can draw a slightly stronger line between. I would also say, I think gaming offers something to young people that they are slightly crying out for, especially young men. And I'd say probably two things. One is community, and generally a community of guys as well. And two is opportunities for mastery. So especially when we look at, you know, how boys are doing at school in general, there's not many opportunities for them to take something they love and become, you know, a pro, become adept and become kind of, build up a reputation for themselves as being good and competent at something. When actually, when you can give them a game, you know, they have ranks, they can rate themselves against their other friends, they can have some competition in it. So there is something there that's actually really valuable to young boys. And actually, I'm pretty neutral on gaming. I've dabbled and I don't do it much, but I think, you know, there's some really good stuff there as well. But if we can offer them more opportunities in real life to have this kind of mastery, you know, get more sports clubs out there, that kind of thing, then that might be a way to slowly draw them back. And also that kind of community aspect. It's really interesting. We talk a lot about women's spaces, and I think that's absolutely important and a vital thing. But actually, I think there's a real space for men's spaces too, for younger men to be with other young men, but also for old and young generations to mix too. And there's something there that we've always used to do, but we don't do quite as much now. And gaming communities are very male dominated. Increasingly, more and more women are joining. But actually, I think there's something there for men where they just really value time talking to other boys.
What can we do as a society to support young boys and men?
Great question. Basically, my job at the moment is trying to figure some of that stuff out. We're looking at young boys in particular to start, 0 to 12. So what can we do there? And then the kind of 12 to 25, what can we do there? And I think there are some real themes that are coming out. One particularly being this, we're seeing this massive correlation between some of the challenges boys are facing and when they don't have a dad. And so we're looking, okay, there's 2.5 young children out there who have got that experience. What can we do for them? And that's things like mentoring and role models, and actually men, older men, taking responsibility for raising up younger men. And I think that's something that we've always kind of expected as a society that men would do. But it seems less and less that men are doing that and taking those roles on. And that's things like, you know, volunteering, working for a youth organization. How can we make volunteering sexy again? That kind of stuff. And actually, you know, we have these problems in the UK. They're called dad deserts, where there will be regions of the UK where you're very unlikely to have a father, and then you'll go to school and there won't be a male teacher in your primary school or your nursery, and you won't see any positive male influence in your life until you're kind of 13 and you're at secondary school. So we're kind of looking into that kind of space. How can we give young boys positive men? And to be honest, if you're a positive man and you think you're all right and you've got your life slightly sorted together but not fully, go and do some volunteering. I mean, find a youth group. They're everywhere. That'll be one start. I think another thing is we're really looking into the school system and then the tech side. So with schools, it's things like I mentioned with the mastery, but also kind of, I think boys need vision more than girls. I think generally, if you say to a girl, you should do this work, you'll do fine. They'll be like, yeah, great, I'll do the work. Boys just don't do work unless they feel like there's a point. So how can we say, look, if you do this maths GCSE, then you can go and do engineering at uni. If you do engineering at uni, you can get this job. Or if you do this now, you can get an apprenticeship. If you're an apprentice plumber, you can earn £40,000 in your third year or something. And 40 grand to a 16-year-old boy is amazing. But how do we give them that vision in the school system that actually work is out there, work is valuable, it can pay you, you can have a good life, you can go on a holiday once a year, that kind of thing, which actually potentially we're lacking in schools. Also things around the kind of the content and the curriculum. So how much time are they spending sat down? How much time are they spending running around? How much time are they spending having sports within the school day? I mean, we see there's a massive gap between the kind of state school system and the private school system. And part of that is because of the way that they conduct themselves. They're getting better grades, but on Tuesdays and Thursdays, the entire afternoon, they're there, you know, 1 till 5. They've not done a single bit of schoolwork because they're out doing extracurriculars or running around on the field. And how do we get that kind of an attitude more into the state system, who are, you know, stressed, sometimes overworked, but actually it's really, really important that kids are able to run around and kind of release that energy. And then I think with the kind of tech side in mind, there are some real no-brainers that we could do. I mean, you guys have got an e-safety commissioner. She sounds like she's doing quite a good job. But things like a tech watershed, things like raising the digital age of consent from 13 to 16, so companies don't get your data, you can't have an algorithm. I mean, just bring Instagram back to the way it was when it first came out, which was that I have 200 friends and when all of them have posted, I don't see anything else. And that's Instagram. I keep in touch with my friends and I don't see more, which is, you know, a whole world away from what it is nowadays. And then really, really tightening up the kind of porn regulation stuff. I mean, how are 12-year-olds accessing what 18-year-olds and up should be? So there's a variety of different things, I'd say. And hey, check out the next report, which is coming out in the next few months, for some more of our ideas. So
great. Out of this report, what role do you think government policy will play in addressing some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big one. I mean, the way we've always, one of the things is, can we put the genie back in the bottle with this stuff? And to an extent, I think we can. I mean, we've always done that with various different things like alcohol and tobacco and even you know, sex and all that kind of stuff. We say that you're not allowed to do it unless you're this age. And I, you know, you presume that before we said that, people were doing it. And the same thing's true with technology. I mean, I did all this research, and then two things happened in my own personal life. And I was like, right, well, I need to go and volunteer at a youth club, and I need to get a flip phone. So I ended up getting a flip phone just because of all this stuff that's happening. And I think government can go a long way to move these kind of conversations onwards. They can make it strict regulations online and on social media companies. They can start looking at the role specifically of men, I think, is really important. We've got one of our government's aims is to get 6,500 more teachers. Actually, within that, I think there's a real, real need for more male teachers in schools, because it's something like a third of them are men. One of our polling things was that polling questions that we asked was that most young men think that the way men are portrayed in the media is just a bit pathetic. And there's a variety of other things in there as well. But how we talk about men and engage with men, you know, they're not all paedophiles. I'm sure many of them are. And actually, to be honest, increasing numbers are because of things like pornography. So we're doing some other work on that kind of language stuff as well. And has it actually changed? Because everyone kind of feels like the way men are perceived has slightly altered in the last 10 years. Even with things like toxic masculinity, we talk about it so much that we're at risk of saying that masculinity is toxic. And we found that I think there was 40-something% of sixth form students in the UK have been told that boys are a problem for society, which as a growing up boy, and maybe men were pretty problematic at times in the history. I think if you're a 15-year-old boy, you know, what responsibility is that on you right now? And you're feeding back all this stuff and thinking, okay, well, what's wrong with me? Yes, government has a part to play, but I think it's quite cultural too. What can we as a society start doing more?
Well, that last comment has reduced me to tears. So thanks, Luke. I have two grandsons, and it makes my heart so sad to think that a society's heading away to labelling them in the way you've just described, you know, and I'm not going to let it happen. Let's chat again after your next report, because honestly, I still have so many questions, and you've been amazing. Cheers.
Kim, no, it's great to talk to you, and good luck with your grandkids and your children, and really nice to chat, and I hope I can see you again soon.
That's researcher and project leader of Lost Boys at the Centre for Social Justice, Luke Taylor. Just 24 years old and one of many Gen Zs taking control of their lives by making mature decisions about their well-being. If you'd like to read the report, you'll find the link to the PDF in the show notes and more information on the Centre for Social Justice in the UK. I'm Kim Clyden. Thank you for joining me today. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Greater Whitsunday Innovation, formerly Split Spaces.